My loves, I don't know if you're like me or many of my friends or a lot of the people that I know, but listen, do you have a cabinet in your kitchen that's packed with supplements and all these amazing things? They're all there to support your overall health, to boost your gut, to boost your vitality, but you ended up being like too overwhelmed to even like look at it and create a routine with them, that you're like just ended up skipping taking your supplements. I've been there too, honey. And this is why I want to take a moment to share an incredible discovery with you, my darling. It's called AG1. And let me tell you, it's been a game changer for me. And how I noticed that it was a big game changer for me was when me and my dad were doing that grief walk from France through Spain. And I got to tell you, the food was delicious, but it wasn't the best for my gut. But how I kept the gut going, how I kept boosting my vitality throughout the walk was every morning I would put a packet of the AG1 into a water bottle and I would shake it up and I would drink it. Even my dad, who's always like, here, dad, here, this is good for you. He's like, no, thanks. And granted, you know, the homie's got, you know, he's doing really well health-wise. But he's always like, nope. But with this, with AG1, he was like, okay, give me some. And he would take it. And it's amazing when you take something, you know, with routine and you start to see the results. It's like, okay, fine. I found my thing. Especially because it's just one serving that has the most straightforward way and simplest way for you to get your vitamins and your nutrients and your minerals and your prebiotics and probiotics. And honestly, why take a bunch of different things when you can just get all of it in one scoop of this delicious magic AG1 powder into a glass of water or into the beautiful water bottle that you get? This is how I start my days, honey. And honestly, if you're a traveler, they also will send you, you could also get the AG1 travel packs, and they're amazing. And every time I have a friend that comes over to the house, I'm always like, here, take a couple of these and try it out for yourself, you know? And I want to share an amazing, exclusive, delicious offer with you today. If you want to take ownership of your health, then try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/sa. So that's drinkag1.com/sa. You got that? And if you don't, go to the show notes. It's there. And cheers to your health and your vitality. What's up, Spiritually Sassy community, and welcome back to the Spiritually Sassy podcast. I'm your host, Sade Simone, and you know this podcast is here to help you heal and develop and create a bold, authentic, and obviously joyful life. Today's guest is none other than my ultimate best friend, my sister, Moon de Simone. Before you get in, girl, let me give people just a tiny little blip about who you are. Moon de Simone is a spiritual teacher, one of the most prolific spiritual teachers I have ever met. And bitch, you know I've met a lot of them. She's also a meditation guide and an artist. She currently lives in New York City, although I wish she lived in Los Angeles. And her teachings are a combination of Buddhism, contemplative psychotherapy, and art. Moon de Simone, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, my love. I am so glad to be back at the Spiritually Sassy Show. I got so excited to be here. I'm running through my words. Hi, my love.
Hi, Spiritually Sassy. I like that too, though. That's very cute. So today I wanted to have you on for us to talk about friendship and relating from the heart. Obviously, the foundation of this conversation is for us to dive deep into the material of my new book, but the backbone of the book is our friendship, yours, ours, you and me, and then our mother, our father, our brother. And the original concept of the book, before anything,
was really a book that was going to be co-written by the three of us. You know, Moon is the older sister, I'm the middle child, and Mickey's the younger brother. So the idea was that for the three of us to write the book. And why do you think people wanted us to write a book together?
Well, I feel like the main thing we have heard from, you know, essentially everyone that we meet is that we are siblings and we are actually each other's best friend. That somehow, some way, we have cultivated that friendship. And even when Mom was still here, there was a real deep level of friendship that we experienced with her and with Dad as well. And I think now more than ever, we're seeing more of that side in him. So I feel like it was such a special time when we were thinking about writing this together. And, you know, I'm so grateful that Karma unraveled the way that it did, because the book is fantastic. You did such an amazing job, my love. I'm so proud, and I'm so glad that I get to be here and talk about it with you, because not only it's a profound book of your own experiences with friendship, not only our family as friends, but, you know, your life in other friendships, but also something that's so necessary today more than ever. Mm-hmm. It's like anyways, let's get started, because I have a lot of things that I want to ask and talk about. And
I want to hear, but I also want to hear this thing that you said, somehow, some way, we're best friends, because that was going to name that too. Everyone that comes into our family unit, they're always like, wow, you, your brother and your sister are like truly in each other's lives in meaningful ways. Like, you guys don't do life without each other. And that isn't something that it was always like that. It's something that we learned. It's something that we developed. It's something that we unsocialize ourselves from, the harmful, petty, unkind, selfish ways, to then re-socialize ourselves in a new way that then brings people together, that brought us together. Can you share more about how that's been for you?
Yeah, I feel like there was... I mean, it's so interesting, because people ask, like, were you guys always this close? And I'm like, actually, no. You know, the truth of the matter is that we were regular teenagers that didn't really look at each other in school. Even though we went to the same school, we had our little things. And it's typical to the age as well. But I really do believe that moving to the States, moving to the U.S. when I was 16, you were 15, and Mickey was 11, 10, 11, was such a pivotal time that we didn't have anyone else. We literally did not know anyone else in this country. We barely spoke the language. And it was by need that we actually became each other's friends, you know? And I remember Mom made such a specific choice to not even have Brazilian TV, so that we would challenge ourselves to watch American TV, so that we would learn the language, we would help each other. And you and I became much closer then, when we went into high school here, not knowing anyone else. And I really do believe that it was through that very challenging time that we actually needed each other, and we allowed ourselves to be there for each other. And I mean, the foundation of how Mom mothered and cared for us was always put each other first, be there for each other, care for each other. That was foundational, always there. So we knew we had that, even if we were on our little fights or whatever teenage kids happen. Deep down, I always felt like, you know, even if we're not talking, if I really needed you, you would be there. I mean, I hope you felt the same. But I think that when we went through the very challenging time of restarting again from nothing, really, mm-hmm. in a brand new country, mm-hmm. we were faced with the challenge of like, wow, we're really alone. Literally, there isn't anyone else here that we know. So we got to really be there, take care, and in a way, get to know each other again, and like really focus on what does it mean to be family, but actually be friends with each other. And mm-hmm. I feel like that really progressed into who we are today, you know, and that it was foundational, because that set the, you know, it's like it created a new foundation that we're like, oh wow, we've gone through all of that because of each other. We survived all of that with each other because of each other. So there is the real sense that we are there for each other no matter what. And it has transformed our lives. And it's such a beautiful thing that I also feel it's so profound that we get to continue to lead from that place, and it continues to honor Mom's legacy, because that was her. It's like her job was to raise us, love us, and make sure that we always had that sense of like connection, you know, that we were really there with each other. And obviously, it wasn't always easy. She lived out that mission. Yeah.
And I want to add that I 100% agree, a million percent. I think moving to America was a big thing for us, for me too, and for all of us. And to me, I think a huge breaking point was leaving the fashion industry 12 years ago. And 12 years ago, can you imagine that was 12 years ago? My God, it's going to be actually 12 years at the end of 2024. It's, you know, it's 11 plus, 11 some. Anyways, I think leaving the fashion industry and then within the first year after leaving, then embarking on that journey to India, and within the first sort of, after I went back, I went to India the first time, you came back with me the second time. And then I think us joining forces towards discovering our, who we are, going on a spiritual mission, like fully unhooking ourselves from what we thought was like the life of, you know, money, power, fame, status, all that stuff, to I want to be a mystic roaming around India and Nepal, and I want to go to ashrams and monasteries, and I just want to develop my mind, and I just want to open my heart, and I just want to help people. I think we bonded over that, and that is really a rare experience, because even in our group of friends, even though we are super close, there's a very few of them who actually even went to India with us to do that kind of thing. People would rather stay home, safe, do something that is closer to their comfort zone. And there's nothing wrong with doing this path or that path. All roads lead home. We know this. And for, I think, the bonding experience that we're talking about, I think the fact that we both wanted this very extreme, intense path of liberation, I think that brought us closer together.
Even closer.
And then another point of contact was when mom first got sick in 2018. And then that was when things got weaved even deeper, not between you and I, because at that point you and I were already inseparable, but I think Mickey came into the picture, our younger brother. And then that's when dad sort of surfaced, like, where have you been? You know, and I think that's when he kind of like really showed up in a big way for us. And then I think for me and dad, what we really deepened was when we went to the walk and through France and Spain, El Camino de Santiago, those 500 miles that we walked together. I think those 32 days walking for about almost 7 hours a day, some hours together, some hours separate. It was the longest amount of time I had ever spent with that. And so I just wanted to throw that in there for like my perspective into the why are we so close?
Yeah. I also, I mean, I know that we have so much to talk about, but I know that also this is good context for people, because I often, I'm always asked, how did I end up going to India the first time? And you pushed me, you challenged me, you came back from India, triggering me, pushing all my buttons, but you essentially waved the flag as in like, hey, there's another way. And I trusted you. Literally, I trusted you fully to be like, you know what? I'm going to follow my brother, my friend, my best friend to go on this path. So the foundation had been building. I think it's important for people to hear this, that things take time. Even though we came from the same C-section, we have been by each other's side our whole lives. Like, you have known me your entire life. I have been there every single day of your life. Fabulous. And yet, the trust for us to be where we are now, it's something that has been building. It is like that garden that we've been watering and planting. We've been counting on each other. We've been there for each other. So when you came back from India the first time in the summer of 2014, and you, it's like you were a different person. I was just like, oh, this person that I knew is now inhabiting really something profound. What is that? I want some of that. But I trusted in what you had found. So I left my whole life behind and went on a one-way ticket with you later that year. So I just think it's important for people to also remember that things take time, you know, like even the deepening and the closeness that we have, we continue to deepen. Even now, you know, we continue to deepen. We don't arrive at a friendship and we're like, okay, we're friends. That's it. I'll throw my hands up in the air and it's done. we're always cultivating, we're always deepening. Like you and I are having even deeper conversations now, obviously through the death of mom, but where our lives are going. Miki and I, same thing, you and dad. Why? Because life continues to challenge us, but we keep showing up by saying, you know
it's
what?
It's a choice.
It's a choice. Yeah.
You're saying you something that I speak about in the book often. And I think it's something that I see so often in why relationships end. It's people are not patient. We expect a friendship we put a seed in the ground today and we expect a full orange tree tomorrow. And I'm going to be able to get an orange tree and I'm going to be able to slice it open and eat it. And we grew up eating oranges with a little sprinkle of salt. And yes. Every time someone comes over here and I have oranges, I'm always like, can I show something to you? Can I show you a little snack? It's unusual. And then when people eat an orange with salt, they're like, oh my God, I love this. But anyways, point is, people are expecting an orange tree tomorrow when in reality it takes years. I don't know how many years an orange tree takes to grow, but I know it takes, I think I heard that an apple tree is like an apple orchard, 7 years. I don't know, but look it up. It's not tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's literally never tomorrow or never within a month or 2 months or 3 months. It takes time. I think a lot of relationships end before they even begin.
Ooh, yeah. Well, what something also that you said on the book, I mean, there's such good things in this book, but you said conflict is for lovers. I love that title of that. It's the title of a chapter. Of a chapter, right?
Yeah, chapter 4.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, is it a subtitle or is it a title? I'm seeing it in my mind. It's the title. Conflict is for lovers. It's like, if everyone knew how much we have worked in our relationships, they'll probably get tired because there were moments that were like, all right, this is too much. But we're like, you know what? No, there's always something that's like, I believe in this. In every one of our close friendships outside of the nuclear family, we have all worked on them. We have all worked on them because what we believe in each other's potential and we believe that there's something there. Of course, I'm not saying that it's like you have to work to the ground. There's a level of discernment, which you also speak on the book. But I think that because of our fear of discomfort, like you said, our fear rooted in our deepest fear, which is the fear of death that you speak so beautifully in the book as well. We're so scared of going through the discomfort of not knowing what's going to happen, of having the difficult conversations, of expressing our needs. And we're like, okay, it's too much. Gotta go. Whereas what if you really give it your all and then you decide, hey, because our practice is to just show up fully. The outcome is not the practice. And I also really appreciate you said something in the book. Okay, I have so many things, but I'm going to just, I need to pace myself.
No. This is great. I love this. I love the speed. I love the intensity. I love the passion. Hello, girl. It's me, honey. And the listener, everyone's listening. You guys are used to my fierceness.
Yeah. Because what happens is, imagine if we, obviously, this is not a perfect world. So we're repairing our childhood and our younger years, but there is still time to, in a way, familiarize ourselves with actually being able to go through the discomfort of being like, wow, I don't know how to do this, but I want to, right? Like, I don't know how to love you, but I want to. I don't know how to ask for help, but I want to. I don't know how to be in a deep, vulnerable relationship, but I want to and I need. It's a real basic need, like you so strongly express in the book. But that vulnerability, which is just this utter discomfort, we're so scared of, and it's actually really, really sad. Someone came to my class the other day and she says, you know, I'm not at the typical age group of this class. I want to say maybe she was like in her 60s or 70s. And she straight up asked, she's like, do you think it's too late for me to be doing this work? And I was like, it's only too late if you think it's too late. You know, again, there's this rush of being young, staying young, getting the orange tree tomorrow, moving through the discomfort tomorrow. We're missing the beauty. We're missing the potential. We're missing the blessings that come even through the most uncomfortable situations. Like, there is no growth outside of discomfort. And I often give this example that, I mean, I know it's heartbreaking, but wasn't it so profound to see how much mom lived in those 4 years that she was still going through cancer treatment? Because she was like, wow, I have this opportunity. Like, she was challenged with life, literally. It was like life and death were dangling at her face every day. But she chose to live. Like, we actually had an incredible time together that she was like, I'm really uncomfortable, but I want to live, but I want to love. I want to go on the trips. I want to do the things. And, you know, I wish for people not to wait until the wheels are falling off or you receive a diagnosis to actually show up. And that's, again, why this book is so important. But it's never too late, you know, to give yourself an opportunity to at least try.
And get your heart broken and experience the rejection and experience the abandonment. And people are, the thing is, we have replayed the times that we have been abandoned and rejected in our minds so much that it's like has like been somatically calcified in your body. So now you are walking in a way that you are sending out a wave of please don't come close. And you're not even noticing how much the way you're walking, the way you are moving through the world. I'm speaking non-verbally here. I'm speaking about the non-verbal cues that your body's sending because of the stories that you've replayed your mind so much that now somatically you are energetically communicating to the world, don't come close to me. My heart's not open. Because of the fear that we have of death, of not knowing, of rejection, of abandonment, of being criticized, all the things that we are robbing ourselves the opportunity to experience. We are expecting ourselves and people to only live in the daylight, only live in the summertime, where we're robbing each other the opportunity to live their full humanity, which comes with grief, which comes with rejection, which comes with loss, which comes with not knowing, you know, which comes with death and sickness. And When we rob each other the opportunity to experience that, to go towards it, life like the depth of your life changes. You know, so your roots don't grow deep with anyone because your roots are like at the tip of the soil. You know, I keep using a garden metaphor because I use a garden metaphor throughout the entire book. We're not saying the thing that we want our friend. We're not advocating for our needs in the friendship to our friends in a way that could risk anything. We're never saying, take me to my colonoscopy. Go with me to the vet with my puppy. Come to my house while I'm doing this preparation for my whatever. Like, and I'm talking about, you know, difficult things like a biopsy or, you know, hard things that we will inevitably all have to go through. We are never giving each other the chance to be rejected or to lean in deeper. Does that make sense? So we keep our cards close, and we are so inappropriately, so toxically self-reliant that our friendships are not sustainable. They're not nourishing. Mm-hmm. They're not nurturing. And the toxic self-reliant thing is something that I spoke to Alua from Going With Grace. She's, you know, the most famous death doula in the world. I just had her on a podcast a couple of days ago. But she spoke about this toxic self-reliancy, toxic self-reliance, yeah, which means I can do it all. I can take care of myself. And it's like, the truth is, no, you can't. It takes a village. You are, it's a lie. It's a full blown lie. So every time you don't say, I don't want to go to the doctor's office alone. I don't want to be alone today. Or do you want to go to the movies? Or do you want to get a coffee? Or do you want to have dinner? Or anytime you don't address that need of connection, of friendship, of depth, of intimacy, of vulnerability in friendship, you are keeping your roots in your own life really shallow, you know, really shallow. And you're robbing the person that you're in communication with the opportunity of meeting you there and blowing your mind and deepening your roots where your both roots can grow deeper together, you know? Mm-hmm.
I just love that so much. You're also robbing the person the opportunity to love you, for them to offer them your love. It's like from a Buddhist perspective, you're literally keeping them from fulfilling a karma of being generous, of actually giving something that they have. But what's also coming up for me now is, as you said, that is that I think that this may also be one of the causes as to why we're so stressed, we're so anxious, and we're becoming physically ill, because deep down, we know we need people. Deep down, inherently, as humans, we know we are completely interconnected and interdependent, and we're not here by ourselves. I mean, we could sit here and list it, we wouldn't even have time in a day to list how many people have come together for us to be experiencing this moment, from our parents, from our doctors, from our people that grew the food, and on and on and on and on and on and on. It's like, I don't know how many people
built the computer, people that built the microphone. Nothing exists from its own side independently, and nothing is self-made. Everything is a community effort. Every single thing in life is a community effort. How are we robbing ourselves of being a community effort?
Out of fear, which is so sad. In a way, yes, it's sad, but if we can accept, okay, cool, this is the conditioning that we're all living with. Right. It's like, we can't rewind the tape. We can't go back and change how we were all raised, but we can do something now. We can say, you know what? I want to live this life fully. Because you said something a little bit ago. It's like, we are all seeking this deep sense of feeling fulfilled by life, of living fully, of even having every emotion, as deeply heartbreaking as they may be, or as incredibly joyous. That's what we really want. We are emotional beings. That's something that, like, it moves us. We do everything because we want to experience something. But we're like, oh, I just got to figure it out. It's like we're always censoring ourselves, keeping ourselves small, which is literally keeping our potential small, and it's stressing the fuck out of us. Literally, where our minds are stressed, our bodies are stressed. We're either trying to fit into someone else's box to fit in and belong, or we're trying to make ourselves small because we don't feel totally safe and comfortable to be who we are. We're stressed. Our bodies are stressed. Our minds are stressed. Inflammation, diseases, illness. And I mean, we know how that goes. And yeah.
Something else coming through. And I think I'll add something to this too. It feels to me oftentimes, I mean, I notice in my own life, I have a note to actually message one of my closest friends to say, hey, I sent you a message saying that I wasn't feeling well 3 days ago, and it's the fourth day, and you still haven't texted me back. You still haven't called me. So calling them in, not calling them out, calling them into their heart, calling them into their body, and calling them in deeper into us growing roots together, right? And I noticed the moment that a couple of days, I was going to do this with two friends, and one of the friends actually wrote me back, not the day after, but the very next day, and a really beautiful message. And I was like, okay, here it is, you know, give it space, give it time, but also have that intention that you want friendships to deepen, that you want to call people into deeper love, deeper intimacy, deeper care, you know. And I've had to go through a lot of like doctor's appointments in the past, and I've asked friends to come with me, and I've asked my father to come with me, and because it's not a place that I want to go alone. It's not a place that's historically safe for queer people of color. So I felt the need. I've always, and now more than ever, now that I know my needs. And I think that's the next thing too, that we should talk about. What are your needs? I think a lot of people don't even know what they need. You know, they don't know. Here's another thing about friendship too that I notice, and I write about this in the book in detail, in a lot of detail, is we expect people to read our minds when they themselves don't even know what they need. But we expect that person to know what we need when we don't know what we need. How can their communication exist? How can friendship exist when you don't know what you need and you're expecting them to know what you need without even saying a word? Yes, there are friendships. Yes, there are connection. Yes, there are family bonds that people can know exactly what you need before you even know. Yes, there are super human capacities like that. But in a very basic level, we don't even know how to address our own needs.
And the scary thing again that goes back to vulnerability is to be able to acknowledge your needs with yourself, beginning that friendship with yourself, right? First and foremost, like, hi, can I be a friend to myself and acknowledge my own needs? I remember when I started deepening my practice, and it was actually so difficult for me to even say, I need this, because my own personal individual curriculum and conditioning is to undermine my needs and put everyone's needs first. The good old people pleaser, let me take care of everyone. So when I had the space to be like, yo, what is it that I need? How is it that I'm feeling? Mind you, this just happened last year after mom died. So I had this like years of spiritual practice, and still there was deepening in my own vulnerability, in my own intimacy with myself that I still needed to do. So again, I had to be patient with my tree that was still growing, to voice my needs to my family, to my friends, and even to myself. And what I also find that's super interesting, it's like you reach out to the friend, just back to that example that it's profound. You reach out to your friend and say, hey, I'm going through this. I reach out to this. What they're going to respond is not your responsibility. It's like it's completely out of the equation, actually. Your practice, our individual practice, is to put out the need, to follow up on the need. Like you said, call them in, call them forward. The outcome is not your practice, because if we don't fulfill that need, or not only that, but if we don't show up for that need as our own practice, the pattern continues to be recreated until we actually give ourselves the space to be truly seen. How people are going to respond, my loves, we will never know, but that's not your job. Your job is to show up fully, because then you know you did your best. You did all that you could. And I think people are so worried and scared of rejection and the outcome of what may or may not happen that they don't even take the step of exposing themselves, right? And it's also such a tricky, confusing kind of a mind fuck, because it goes back to like, I'm so self-reliant, I can't take care of myself, but we actually don't know how to do that because we're undermining the need to actually have people in our lives. So it's like, it's so contradicting and confusing, and no wonder we're so stressed and this loneliness pandemic is on fucking fire. What do you think has helped you to open up this space? Because, I mean, I know you very personally, but as far as like open up this space to let other people in to the deeper, closer, more intimate parts of you, you know?
That's such a good question. And there's two things I want to say. I want to talk about that. And I also want to talk about people pleasing. So don't let me forget.
Oh, I won't.
In regards to bringing people in, it's what I talk about in the book. It's turning the lights on, which means I have said to myself all the unkind things anyone could ever dream of saying. I have been the most horrific, awful enemy to myself. And what that also gives me the grace, and that gives me the power and strength, is to actually have faced every corner of my story. Therefore, I've met my demons. Are they still here? Some. Have they all gone? No. What does that mean? That I have met my darkness. And I think we can only truly let people into the depth of our being in creating close relationships once we have done the work of turning the light on, which means going to the areas in our house, meaning our inner sanctuary, our inner house, that old Victorian mansion that's like from the outside looks haunted, but bitch, that's your house. That's your inner world. Going to every single room in a house, to every single bathroom, to every single living room, to all the areas in the closet, attic, basement, all of it, to all the areas that you neglect. You live in one room that's full of clutter, and all those other rooms, you keep them locked. And you think that by keeping them locked, what's in them won't impact the energetic atmosphere of the rest of your house. But because everything is interdependent and interconnected, it is impacting the energetic atmosphere. That's why there is a sense of heaviness to your being. Although you're like, I'm fine. But there is a weight. There is a, that is that. This is what I'm speaking to. So how I've let people win was I have actually met my darkness. I've actually like sat with my demons. I've actually like had dinner with them multiple times. So many times that I know their script. I know what they need in order for them to go off. I know what they need in order for them to take a little nap for a couple years and to then show up again and give me a new mm-hmm. curriculum. This is how. Now, a lot of people don't deepen relationships with other people because they are still fighting with reality. They're mm-hmm. still neglecting, rejecting that things did happen, that they did hurt people and that other people did hurt them and that they did hurt themselves. They are neglecting the trifecta of hurt that takes place in every human being's biography. Therefore, if you haven't met the hurt, if you haven't met the pain, if you haven't met the shadow, and you're unwilling to stop fighting reality, then you're not going to be able to engage with other people in a really deep, intimate way because you're like, what are they going to say about the way I've hurt myself or the ways I keep hurting myself? What are they going to say about the hurt that I've caused other people? What are they going to say about the ways that I, you know, have or continue to hurt? The shadow of our, the shadow work that's required for intimacy to work is vital. You have to have met your shadow. You have to have met your demons in order for you to invite people in, and you're fine. You know, does that make sense? Because there's something about, can I just add one more thing too, just really briefly? There's something else that came up, and I speak about this in detail in the book too. It's like, how can you invite people into your house if your house is a mess? Like, you're not going to want to invite anyone over because your house is a mess. I'm not talking about your physical, your house that you live in, your apartment. I'm talking about metaphorically the house of your spirit, your inner world, you know? Mm-hmm. And if your house is a mess, if you don't know what you're going to find in there, how are you going to invite other people? You know, you're like, oh, I don't know what we're going to find here. And I don't know what may come up. So I'm just not going to ever bring people too close. But, and this is from one side, right? This is from your side. And also, there are the 15 closest people to us, which I speak about in the book based on Dunbar's research. The 15, and within the 15, there's a 5. In that category are super close and close people. Those people that you are, the people that you are inviting into that deeper aspects of yourself, that you are willing to open yourself up and be intimate with, they have to have done similar work. And it's a nonverbal knowing. It's a somatic attunement, to use the words of Dr. Scott Lyon. He says it's a somatic attunement. We know it's a bullshit detector. We know when someone has done the work. We know when someone has turned on the lights. We know when someone has had dinner, multiple dinners with their demons or not. So we can bond over that. And the friendship isn't about trauma bonding. It's about, this isn't the foundation of the friendship, you know, because you think, oh, we've done shadow work. Now it's a friendship is all about trauma and pain and our shadow. No, you have a strong foundation to build upon. You know, sometimes you see those houses up on the hills or in the mountain and you're like, how's the house even standing? It's because they have deep, strong roots in the ground. And that's what turning on the lights do. And that's what deep shadow work does. And now you can build your friend's house next to yours and the platform will hold.
The platform will hold. I also think it's important. I mean, there's just so many things that I want to point out and ask. I also think it's something, number one, so important that the foundation of the book is spiritually we, right? The healing, transformation, liberation is relational. It does not happen by yourself. We have the story of Ananda. You so beautifully tell on the book. We can talk about it for those of you that don't know. But I just want to say something. Healing is relational. Even how we learned our conditioning, or rather how we internalize our conditioning, was relational. And that relationship now is also, how are you relating with your inner world, with your inner house, like Sa said, how are you relating with the demon so that you can do the healing work? So it is always relational, whether it is you with yourself. The interesting things, like the duality is always there, but we're not limited to it, right? But we have to be able to work with it. And when Sai's talking about he's had dinner with the demons, is because you know that the demons are parts of the house, are parts of you, but not the truth of who you are. Otherwise, there isn't a way to relate with them. You know, the truth of who you are, sometimes, I know when we used to teach together, we used to talk about this house analogy, and I also still keep talking about it. I say that the truth of who you are is the foundation of the house, not the rooms itself. It's like the ground, the walls, and the root of the ceilings of the house. That's your truth. And the rooms that can change, they're always changing, is the conditioning, the demons, the wounds, the traumas. But all of that is changeable, malleable, forgivable, right? That is all. There's a way to work with them. I think what keeps happening is that we're so addicted to our suffering, keep attaching and identifying ourselves to the demons, to the parts, to the wounds, to the hurts, to the rejections, which makes sense. We don't have enough space to relate. We're in that surface. And then we miss the opportunity to relate more deeply, more vulnerably to ourselves and to others. And then you don't know why you feel so kind of like numb and disappointed and just going through the motions, because it requires the deep, hardcore dinners, uncovering, going to those rooms. And like you so beautifully said, you're not going to want to let people into your inner home, because you feel you're still believing you are those parts. So you're still believing, oh, I'm ashamed, or I'm guilty, or it's their fault, or it's that. So this is all contraction inside, holding back inside. There isn't a place to just open and be honest and vulnerable, or just acknowledge, wow, these are the stuff that's happening. Here's me having had those experiences.
My loves, let's take a quick break from the episode, because I got to share something with you that is delicious, mind-blowing, and kind of really sweet of a surprise for me. Backstory, which probably all of you know by now, I have struggled with acne scars for as long as I can remember. And I say struggle as in I've always wanted to not have them, you know? And of course, cystic acne is gone, which is wonderful, but the scars are there and they're deep and they are, they're always like, good morning, Sa, how are you, darling? Nice to see you again. And I have spent so much money trying to get rid of these scars. I have, you know, literally gotten, I mean, it's pointless to mention, I have done pretty much all the things available under the sun to be able to change the texture of my skin, to be able to say goodbye to the acne scars. For me, because for you, if you think I don't look cute with my acne scars, it is a reflection of the quality of your mind, okay? Let's just put that into perspective for a second. So anyways, I get sent a lot of products all the time. People that want to participate in podcasts, people that want me to talk about their products. And I'm extremely fierce about the brands and the products that I talk about, because I have to be a trustworthy source for my community, my students. And so anyways, this product found me, and I'm so glad it did. It's called One Skin. And the product's necessarily not built for acne scars. It's built for a variety of other different benefits, which I don't need them right now, or I don't think I will need them, because I'm fine with the way my skin is aging. However, if you're interested in transforming your aging process in a way that is healthier looking or more relaxed looking or whatever it may be for you, the point is, I want to share with you this product founded by four female PhD level longevity scientists with over 15 years of experience studying the biology of aging. The product that I'm holding in my hand right now is called One Skin OS One Face. I wash my face
and I put this on and I put sunscreen on and that is all. And in 1 week, honeys, I swear to you, it is wild. The texture of my skin is changing so much. I'm like, this can't be true, you know, because I always dream of a product like this. But hey, now it is here, you know. And unlike most skincare products on the market, One Skin works deeper than the surface level. And it's designed to promote healthier skin from the inside out. And check this out. In an independent 12-week clinical study, OS1 Face, which is the product that I'm holding in my hand, the product that I'm talking about, demonstrated efficacy by strengthening the skin's barrier and significantly reducing visible signs of aging. In the study, they were able to have these epic results. Wrinkles were diminished in 87% of users. And 95.5% of the people who were in the study and this clinical trial experienced improved firmness. One Skin is for everyone that wants to prevent or reverse the signs of aging with groundbreaking approach. One Skin addresses skin health at the molecular level, targeting the root cause of aging so skin behaves, feels, and appears younger. It's time for you to get to experience a new skin health routine. And I'm offering you, as a listener of the podcast, a 15% discount when you use code capital SAH, my first name, you should know by now, at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code SAH. And it's oneskin.co. And the code is capital SAH. And enjoy, my darling, because we only have one body, one skin, and only you can choose to make it better. Age healthy with One Skin.
You speak about, I think it's the last chapter. No, I was trying to pull up the book, but you know, the last chapter that you talk about transfiguration of the past, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which I think it's the way for us to really be able to connect deeply in this way. How do you work with the parts of the house? Right? How do you work with the room?
Yeah. I think let's just create some context for people who are like, you know, transfiguration is the spiritual potential that all things hold, right? Which means how we see the experience, how we see someone, how we see anything is based on our conditioning. Transfiguration is based on how our spirit, our soul, our pure mind, heart sees it, which that requires a lot of work. And it's also that transfigured view, it's one that's not only beneficial to yourself, but it benefits all. So that's like a higher plane, higher magic, higher tantra. It requires you to have done really, really severe, intense, powerful, deep work. So the book carries people through the stages of arriving at that place to get you to see yourself, your life, the experience you've had through the spiritual potential that they all hold. Before we talk about transfiguration, let's talk about people pleasing. There's two sides to it. Yeah. There's two sides to it that I speak about in the book. One, which shows up as the fixer syndrome. And the fixer syndrome is, you know, we are insatiably trying to fix everyone and everything around us because we are unwilling to look at ourselves. We're unwilling to address our own discomfort. So by fixing other people, it's a way for us to distract ourselves from fixing ourselves. And the word fix is not the right word, but it gives context to how we go through our lives, right? And then there's the other side of the people pleasing too, which is a really deep desire to be of help, a really deep bodhisattva, saintly, holy, heart-centered desire to help people, to ease their suffering, to help them. But I think the most shadowy aspects of people pleasing is people who are believing that they know or that they hold the power of how somebody else should, capital S, live their lives and do their human thing.
Do their human thing. And you know what's also so fascinating that you and I have talked about this before? It's so righteous, actually, to think that you yes. need someone else needs. It's like, oh, we are such cute, righteous fucking beings. Let's be real. I know what you need. Let me tell you how to live your fucking life. No, my love, actually. And what I have found over the, especially this last year, it's like, I don't know what else could have come out of this year, but thankfully a lot of fucking wisdom because the survival is necessary, is that we are, the righteousness is a protection of our inability to be with the vulnerability to say, I don't know. I'm scared. I need you. Actually, you go do you and I'm going to try to do me. But again, it goes back to that thing of like our inability to be with our own discomfort. Then we're wanting someone else to approve and validate our discomfort by making the same choices, by making sure that they choose the same thing. And then we're just in that trap of like conditioning, suffering, re-traumatizing. And what do you think? I mean, I have had a lot of the people pleasing tendencies in my history, as you know. So what do you think?
Go off, girl, from go off.
No, that's all. I want to ask you a question. Okay, go off.
Got to go. Deliver.
I want you to tell us, how do we find that balance? Because it's very easy to let the altruistic bodhisattva, I'm helping people, but they need me. How do we find the middle way to actually be in the dance of like, this is me trying to protect and distract from myself needing me, the discomfort of not knowing, the vulnerability, the intimacy of being with myself, and like, oh, wow, I can actually be there for you. Here is my true altruistic nature ready and willing to support you. That's a very fine line to be in that dance.
Very, 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 very fine line. And it's one that I'm still like getting better and better every day. You know, it's because it's such a high to help people. It's the greatest, most sustainable high of all is the helper's high. It's the bodhisattva high. It's helping somebody to ease their suffering. It's the greatest high of all highs. No drug could ever nurture your spirit and tickle your soul in the same way as the helper's high. So it's important to just preface by that. So it could also lead to some degree of, you know, of unconscious seeking that thrill of helping, you know. Mm-hmm. I think the fine line, the balance comes from knowing your needs. It goes back mm-hmm. to what we talked about earlier, knowing your needs. What do I need on a daily basis? And then also, I speak about this in the book in detail too, people are setting boundaries without knowing what they value. They're setting up all of these boundaries. They're like behind a concrete wall. Their heart is behind a concrete wall. But they're putting up boundaries without even knowing what they value. And if you don't know what you value, then you don't know how to live in integrity. If you don't know how to live in integrity, then you are just going to continue to unconsciously people please or push people away. It's one or the other, you know, it's this push and pull. It's the two extremes. Let me do everything I can to make sure that you think I'm a good, loving person, or please get the fuck away from me. And sometimes the word please doesn't even come up. It's just like, no, away from me. So these extremes goes back to people not knowing their values. So a big exercise that I have in the book, it's many actually deep, funny, some sassy questions to get you to understand what do you value in life. And unless you know what you value, you're not going to know what your needs are. And if you're not going to know what your needs are, then you're not going to live in integrity with your needs. And then you're not going to be able to set your boundaries around your needs. You're not going to know this need is not being met and this experience has crossed my boundary. Therefore, stop, you know, let me attend to this. Give me space to tend to this need that's being neglected. So that's my answer to that.
That's my answer to that. Yes.
It's because I know it so well because I wrote in such a detail in the book. That's why it sounds so like clear, because this was a chapter in the book that I was going through it so much, you know? So, self-revelation of the hardship, the wisdom was like potent.
Something that I want to add and ask for you to elaborate on is when we talk about needs, let's just also remember that we have our conditioned needs and we also do have our inherent, deeply human, necessary needs. And you speak so beautifully about them in the books. They need to belong. They need to be seen. They need to feel safe. They need to feel heard. Like the same way as we need shelter and food to survive. Those are truly our basic needs. Where I think people get caught is that, especially in the helper's high, going back to that, is that there's a part of us that feels a sense of belonging. The conditioning, the conditioned parts of us has felt, right? Like, this is my curriculum. I learned the sense of belonging, feeling seen and safe and held when I am helping, when I am serving. So when I do not, I have to grapple with those needs myself. Back to the beginning of relating with yourself. So I have to be here. Is it true that I only belong when I help? That's where the relational work with ourselves, sitting with those shadow, cute little dragons inside. You say the demons, I say the dragons, same. And saying, actually, it's not true. That's the conditioning. That's the people-pleasing tendency conditioning that I learned. But now as the adult, I realize, actually, I'm still whole. I belong. I'm safe. I am enough. Even when I say, no, I can't do that for you now because I need something from and with myself. So again, the dance takes time. And you speak about this on the book at the later chapters for a reason, right? Because it builds up. And like you said, it's something, again, back to the orange tree. It takes time, my love. Sai and I have been doing this practice for a decade, each of us. And we're still, we're still challenged as anyone else does. I just want to make a parenthesis here for everyone listening to this. If someone says, hey, I'm healed, come this way. You should be like, honey, are you okay? LOL, walk away. Because it is not, it's not real. That's not true. Sai and I are so vulnerably sharing our stories here with you all for you to hear that we're 10 years in practice, deep, profound, integrated, embodied practice, and we're still challenged. We still have dinners with the demons. Why? Because the work continues. Because life challenges us. Yeah. Because life challenges us in different ways, which brings up different things that we need. Back to that relational friendship with yourself and your potential. And then you create, and then you offer, and then you serve.
I love this so much. And one thing that comes up for me too, in regards to this like relationship to ourselves and our insatiable need to distract ourselves, it's really hard in today's world because of social media. You know, we are fed this idea that And neurochemically, like I speak to a scientist in the book, who's also an addiction expert, about how the connection that we get from the phone isn't. She says the word. Dr. Rachel Wooserman says it's like eating Wonder Bread in America. If you're not here, you won't know what that is. But it's like this white bread that's really, it's like that perfect combination of salty and sweet. It's like so, and you put a little butter on that shit and it's like, oh my God, heavenly. And it's also subsidized by the government. So it's like really cheap bread. It's extremely unhealthy, but you could kind of, anyways, point is, it's like eating Wonder Bread. That shit fucks you up. But what happens is you get a little high from it. It's like empty calories. And it's the high that we get from sugar. The social media thing is robbing us from the opportunity of knowing our needs. Because when a need strikes and you haven't like learned how to sit with yourself and how to like to have that relationship with yourself as you so beautifully shared. What we will do when a need strikes because it feels like discomfort, We will immediately distract ourselves. We immediately go to the phone. And that's robbing you from getting to know yourself, you know, at a really deep level. So I saw someone said this the other day in the podcast. I forgot who or if I was in someone else's podcast, but someone said, oh, I think it was on Sahara Rose's podcast. And she says she saw a meme that was going viral of me and my best friend doing best friend shit. And it's her. It's like two people. This was on Sahara. This was something that popped up in Sahara's Explore page. Two people next to each other scrolling on their phones. And what they are doing there, if we need to cycle somatically, spiritually, break down what's happening, it's literally they have nothing to talk about because their roots are shallow. They don't know who they are. They haven't met their demons. Two, they are uncomfortable in their bodies. So they're choosing to distract themselves. And once someone is distracted and they're not choosing to unhook themselves from distraction, it invites the other person to neglect themselves as well. And now the phone is really a great tool of self-neglect, you know? And one may say, oh, it's auto-regulation. Yeah, it does do that sometimes. Sometimes you're just coming home and you're like, can I just drink a cup of tea and just scroll on social media? That's all I want to do. I want to go to bed and scroll. Because there is a degree of auto-regulation there, of self-regulation. I don't like to put self and auto-regulation in the same place because self-regulation does require you to do some work. Auto-regulation is like TV watching or social media, you know? Mm-hmm. So I went on a whole rant there, but I hope it's clarifying.
It makes total sense. It makes total sense. What you're saying is in this world of technology, we think we are connecting. We think we are regulating and we think we are co-regulating. But what it is, it's like we're not listening to what you said in the book that so beautifully, instead of seeing loneliness as a cue for something you need, we give in to the phone because it's so easy. It's like this box is in our hands always. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can we just go to the phone?
Yeah.
How can you talk about this idea of seeing loneliness as a cue for us to actually tend to that?
Yeah, it's loneliness is a physiological cue like hunger. And I think I didn't know this until I was doing research for the book. I had no idea. I literally was just like, oh my God, I feel so lonely. Let me smoke a cigarette. Let me do this. Let me do that. Let me do whatever I want, whatever I can to distract myself. Because saying to anyone, oh my God, I feel lonely, it was a weakness. You know, it was seen as something bad, something to actually even be like disgusted by. Like, I'm so lonely. Oh, like, you know, it had this like energy of like, oh, you're so needy. You shouldn't be needy because life is not about being needy. Life is about being self-reliant. Life's about being independent. And this toxic independence that capitalistic culture breeds is harming us and depleting us and making us sick psychologically, physically, and spiritually. But to go a layer deeper into your question, it's through the research of the book, I realized, wow. When I feel hungry, I grab something to eat. When I feel thirsty, I grab some water. When I feel tired, I take a nap. But when I'm lonely, I don't make, not me personally. I've always kind of reached out. I mean, not say I've always, no. Let me be brutally honest. I have had many years of toxic, self-reliant behavior. And auto-regulation through, you know, drugs and alcohol to medicate the feeling of illness, to subside, to put away, to neglect. But through the research of the book, I was like, oh my God, this needs to be, we need to teach in schools, you know, like you are neglecting yourself of a basic need, which is connection, which is friendship, which is intimacy. And then this leads to another point. It's the fact that unless we have these deep, intimate connections, we are going to die a sour death, lonely, in a hospital bed by ourselves, with no one holding our hand, with no one next to us, with no one whispering loving words like, let go. You can let go as you die. You know, it's something that I've seen in a hospital. It's something that I hear often. And we can do death better. We can do death differently. We can do death more gracefully if we are in community.
If we are in community, yeah. And then hopefully then we wouldn't be so scared of the most basic natural part of life. Because if we knew, oh, I have people around me. I have people around me now. I have people around me when I'm sick, when I'm in need. I'm there for people. People are there with me. We're so scared because maybe deep down we're so scared, of course, of what is going to happen, our inability to accept the simple fact that we're going to die, but also what's going to happen, who's actually going to be there, you know?
That's right. That's right. And then the fact that we don't prioritize connection in our lives and don't prioritize friendship in our lives is, I mean, there's so much I want to say and we're coming up to the time. It's robbing us from living meaningful lives because there's research about this. When you get good news and you just receive the good news and you're sitting in your apartment by yourself, you get happy and it really just passes very briefly. You know, very quickly. Now, if you get good news and you call a friend or you say, hey, can we meet for dinner? I have great news. And you go to dinner and you celebrate and that friend celebrates you. That friend has what we call in Buddhism, sympathetic joy. They're happy for your happiness. The joy that it becomes sustainable. It lasts longer. It elongates, it stretches. And it has depth. Right? Back to the roots, exactly. And now when you share sad news with a friend and they can be sad with you, the burden becomes lessened. Mm-hmm. So it really is like a call to action that we must work towards ending this loneliness epidemic. And it has to be done together. There's no way that we are... that we're going to end this epidemic of lack of friendship without reaching out. And one thing I want to say too, Beast, becoming socially integrated, you know, a lot of people don't know their neighbors, don't know the people who work at their coffee shop, don't know anyone that they interact with on a regular basis, you know.
We're so caught up. We're so busy trying to go on the next post and like the next thing. We're so uncomfortable with just being present. I said this in a class today where life is trying to love us. People are trying to love us. Ooh. Life is trying to love you. Life's trying to love me and everyone. We are lovable by nature. Literally, inherently lovable. But you're at the coffee shop and you're on your phone and you miss life trying to love you, a person, an interaction, the sunrise, a rainbow, a blessing. It's like, even the other day, I was so busy leaving acting class. Not so busy, but I was just like, I was leaving and I was like, trying to like, go have dinner. I was like, I want to leave. I want to have dinner. And then this girl was leaving the class and she's trying to like have a conversation with me. And then I had to tell myself, Moon, be here. Yes, you're going to go have dinner. I just needed that moment to relate with myself and then go have a nice 5-minute conversation with this lovely person. And then it's like, okay, we've set up a connection. If I'm there, I need to get home. I'm tired. I'm hungry. Oh my God. Over worrying about what's not here and then trying to distract myself because I feel a bit uncomfortable or vulnerable or something. And then you go to the phone and then you distract. You get that. It's like auto-regulation, but in a way, how often we reach out for that, it's like a false sense of regulation because we're just distracting again.
Oh, yeah.
So then
yeah.
The pain is still there. The loneliness just gets deeper and deeper. And like you said in the beginning, it almost becomes calcified so much that you believe you are unlovable because you've been lonely for so long. Ooh. So it's like we're on this trap. We're trapped. But there's a way. There's a way. You are the way. And like, I mean, let me just, again, like Stein and I have just gone through the worst year of our lives. So I'm sitting from a place of like, if I could survive that, if I could move through that and still be willing to serve, to love and to open and actually look for blessings, I really do believe more than ever that there is a way. Again, I've learned these lessons through the death of my mother. So everything carries a potential for us to see this sense of love in ourselves and in life. And it takes work, but it's possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. I get excited. No, you need to get excited. You need to get excited because that's so beautiful. Life's trying to love us. Who said this to me the other day? Oh my God. Tenzin Choki said something like this. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my Buddhist teachers, she said something like that too. That life is trying, that what if everyone around you are Buddhas conspiring to lead you to enlightenment? What if everyone around you is here to support you to become liberated and become a Buddha in this lifetime? Mm-hmm. How about that? We did talk to her. I did talk to her as well for the book. So you get to hear her words, her teachings in the book as well. Okay, we've got to go. Moon, I love you so much. Where can we find you?
Sa, I love you so much. Thanks for having me, my love. I'm just sitting here being like, yay!
Tell us where we can find you. Go. Thank you.
I know. I'm just telling everyone for one moment to rejoice. One moment to rejoice on like having meaningful, delicious conversations. Wow. We deserve this time. You deserve this time. There is enough time to love. There is enough time to try again. There is enough time to show up. You have time. We have time. Come from this place of like, wow, there's enough love. There's enough time. There is enough of potential.
I'm just 3 minutes late to a meeting. That's why.
Oh, you're literally late to a meeting. Well, sorry.
But thank you for reminding us to pause and rejoice. That's beautiful. Where can we find you, girl?
You can find me on Instagram, MoundSimone. If you are in New York City, come to Sage and Sound. I have weekly classes there 3 times a week. You can find me online. I have space for one-on-one coaching, the Modern Dakini membership, which is a modern temple, a online community for women ready for greater self-expression and real liberation. And there is a summer retreat coming up. Yeah, go on Instagram, follow me, sign up for the newsletters, things come. And yeah, this is it.
Okay, so yeah. At Moon de Simone on Instagram, you can find her there. And thank you for being on the show. What a joy. What a delicious conversation. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe we're sisters. I love you so much. Thank you.
I love you so much.
I really love you all. Thank you for being here. And if you haven't gotten a copy of my new book yet, Spiritually We is out. Everywhere books are sold. Get your copy. And I should not be so humble right now. I know the book will help you to relate to yourself and to the world from your heart. Let's do this together. We can end the loneliness epidemic. I love you all. Take good care. See you on the other side. All the links for you to order the copy are in the show notes, or you could just look it up. Spiritually We by Sa De Simone. Available everywhere books are sold. Love you. Goodbye. Okay, I'm calling on all the home bar enthusiasts right now. Are you ready to create a new kind of bar experience? One that's sober and filled with magic? Let's create a bar that goes beyond the ordinary, honey. And let's infuse it with the spirit of adventure, wellness, and connection. And listen, with that in mind, I need to share with you Anima Mundi's Apothecary and their wonderful brand new elixir collection. When I saw that, I was like, honey, we got to share this with the community immediately. Even if you're not interested in becoming fully sober, you're sober curious, you just want to, you know, kind of try something different that's still going to make you feel good and sassy and delicious and be like, ooh, I like this. Then this is for you. One of their elixirs that I adore, it's the Euphoria. It's composed of organic, wildcrafted, and ethically grown botanicals. It's like a potion for joy. And trust me when I tell you this, honey, for those of us who are on a sober journey, or if you are in a sober curious journey, you're going to drink this, honey, and you're going to be like, ooh, girl, what's in this shit?
But hey, honey, it's just a bunch of amazing organically grown botanicals mixed together to give you that, ooh, I like this feeling. You know what I mean? And they have this Elixir Kit Barista Series. It is gorgeous, iconic, legendary. Buy it for your house or also buy it for a friend. That got to be a sweet friend, honey, because that's going to require you a little bit more of an investment. You could also just get each of the elixirs by themselves, right? And it's an invitation for you to become a spiritual mocktail barista in the comfort of your own home. You know, trust me, you're going to love it. Your body is definitely going to love it. Your mind will thank you and your soul will be like, okay, honey, okay, lit. Listen, and I guarantee you that people that try these elixirs are going to be like, oh, what's going on, honey, over here? I mean, you got to find a recipe that works, but this is the base of it. It's delicious, amazing, and it's going to get you lit. Are you ready to unlock the magic of this elixir collection, honey? Head over to animamundiherbals.com. I'm going to try to spell that for you. animamundiherbals.com. Herbals is spelled herbals.com. Or instead of you listening to spell this, you know, trying to pass the spelling bee over here, go to the link in the show notes. And listen, don't forget to use code capital SAH number 1 and number 5, SAH15 at checkout for an exclusive 15% off your order. Okay. Bless all this beautiful, sober, spiritual bar experiences that you're about to create. Love you.